My brother keeps a human head in his closet. I hope I don't end up that way.
This thing, it's gonna follow you. Somebody gave it to me, and I passed it to you. It could look like someone you know, or it could be a stranger in a crowd. It could look like anyone.
Help!
Santa Claus only brings presents to them that's been good all year. To the ones that ain't done nothing naughty. All the other ones. All the naughty ones. He punishes you. See Santa Claus tonight? You better run, boy. You better run for your life.
Bring me one of those chickens.
You got money to pay for it?
You paid for it.
No, but we're the king's men. So, you got money?
Not a penny. I'll still take that chicken.
You don't seem to understand the situation.
I understand that if any more words come pouring out your mouth, I'm going to have to eat every chicken in this room.
You lived your life for the king. You're going to die for some chickens.
Someone is.
Symbol is associated with a pagan deity named Bagul. He consumes the souls of human children. Early Christians believed that Bagul actually lived in the images themselves and that they were gateways into his realm.
I am seriously positive these were not here. How would we have, like, just made a campsite in between three piles of rocks just by coincidence? You don't think this is strange?
Hello, welcome once again to Dark Discussions, your place for the discussion of horror film, fiction, and all that's fantastic. I am one of your co-hosts, Philip, from the state of New Hampshire in the US of A, and with me in the state of Michigan.
This is Eric.
Eric, how are you, sir?
I am here.
Very good. And in the state of New York?
This is Mike.
Mike, how's it going?
Okay, how are you, Phil?
Good. And in the state of Massachusetts?
Hey everyone, this is Abe.
Abe, how's it going?
I'm doing well.
And we have a Connecticut American.
This is Chrissy.
Chrissy, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Well, we could have done better, but we had technical issues for a half hour. So, either way, we do have a couple of things. First off, Eric, you do another podcast with your buddy Dan that was on hiatus for a couple of weeks, but it's back.
It will be. We'll be recording again this weekend. That's a general interest podcast called the Ascansity Podcast.
Mike, you do a genre book?
Yeah, I do. It's called Unnatural Selections. You can find it at www.unnaturalselections.com.
And Chrissy, you do things?
I do lots of things. You can find out more about me at ChristyPetersonSchoonover.com. I'm mostly I write short dark fiction.
And Abe, you do a genre blog.
Yep, it's called A Real Movie Reviewer. Best way to find it is go to search engine and type in a realer, R-E-E-L-R Movie Reviewer. Or you can go to the search engine to visit the Dark Discussions main page, and you can find it on the right-hand side to where there's a link to my blog there. And everything else is mentioned in passing, and there's also a few other sites that might pique your interest if you feel like visiting them.
That's right. And here it's www.darkdiscussions.com, which is the website for the podcast. You find all 270-plus episodes there, as well as our sister podcast. Also, as Abe mentioned, the links to all the things that were just stated. Plus, at the bottom of every page are links to iTunes, Stitcher, where you also can find the podcast, Dark Discussions Podcast Facebook group, Dark Discussion 1 would be the Twitter, and also at the bottom of the page is the email address link, which is darkdiscussions@aol.com. And if anybody wants to email us, they can. Also, we do have at the top of the page a button for Patreon. Patreon is a place where you can donate to the podcast. We aren't necessarily asking for any donations. However, some of our listeners requested it because they wanted to give back to the podcast. So for doing so, we put up the Patreon account page, which is patreon.com/darkdiscussions. Or the button on darkdiscussions.com homepage. And for every $5 that people donate, we are giving back, where you, the listeners get to choose a film that we discuss, any genre film. And basically what happens, for example, if you donate $15 for the month of March, you could then, at the end of the month of March, list three films, like The Killer Eye, or Dear God No, or Hell Hole, and all three will be thrown into the figure of hat. Or you could say Hell Hole three times, so for every $5, doesn't matter if it's dupes. And then at the end of the quarter, for all those folks who have donated money, we pull out of our figure of hat a winner, and we will do an episode. Since not many people necessarily donate to the podcast, your chances of winning are high. And so far for Q3 of 2016, we did The Howling, which was picked. And then the Q4 of 2016, The Ninth Gate, which is an upcoming episode. So folks can go to patreon.com/darkdiscussions. Now, Eric, there's a contest.
There is a contest. I have put a post up on our Facebook group, and Phil has pinned it there. So you can go there to read about it if you need a reminder. Also, if you're listening to this podcast and you are not a member of our Facebook group, go sign up right now, because right now we have 665 members. We need one more, and we're at 666. Blah, Satan. All right. So... the contest, it's a story contest. You get to write a story about a particular topic. Topic is my cat. My cat is doing something that's creeping me out, which is that she's shutting herself in the bathroom in the dark and sitting in the corner. And she'll stay there for a long time. I could open the door and she's just sitting there in the corner moping for some reason that I don't understand. Contest is for you to write a story approximately 150 words long, a creepy, spooky, scary story explaining why my cat is exhibiting this behavior. Send it on in and we will read it on the air and your name will be put into a hat. And at the end of March, we will take everybody's name who's given us a submission and draw one out, and the winner will get a Blu-ray copy of the movie Krampus. So yeah, that's the contest.
Yep, that's right. So basically, flash fiction. So, Chrissy, explain what a flash fiction is.
Flash fiction is generally fiction that is 1,500 words or shorter. Some places consider it 1,000 words or shorter. So, I mean, me personally, I consider flash to be between 1,000 and 1,500 or under. That is flash fiction. So,
right. I'm confused. I thought last time we were saying 150.
No, actually.
There's also microfiction, Eric.
Right.
Okay. What are we doing? Because you guys are the ones that are hung up on the word count. What are we doing?
Well, let me explain, Eric. For example, for folks who want to put it in perspective, if you write one regular sized page, single spaced, that's 500 words. If you write one single page double spaced, that's 250 words. So anything like that is perfect. How's that, Eric?
Okay, cool.
There you go. So basically one page or less, your choice, single, double space, doesn't matter. And I think we're good. Mike, you mentioned...
Phil.
Off air about a very, very unfortunate passing.
Yeah, unfortunate and shocking, because it's really, I don't think anyone knew this might happen, which was a fan favorite character actor, I would call him character actor, Bill Paxton, I know him best from Aliens, I guess, but Aliens, Terminator, Predator 2,
Near Dark,
Edge of Tomorrow, Titanic, for Christ's sake,
The Call,
Twister,
Frailty,
you know.
Apollo, whatever.
Apollo 13. Yeah. So it's, this is a guy who has, you know, kind of been in the background of so much great genre stuff for so long. And he, I guess, was having surgery and died during surgery. And
that's kind of freaky. I don't know what he was having surgery for.
And is at age 61, so youngish. Young, I mean, not young for dating your daughter, but young for dying. And it's not like somebody that you said, well, he's been sick for a long time, or you know, people knew that he had problems, or that he was a drug addict, or anything like that. That you could go, well, we understand. No, that's just kind of out of the blue. So it's really kind of shocking and sad and disappointing, because it kind of seemed like, you know, he was popping up in things like Edge of Tomorrow and doing well in them, and he was having a little bit of a resurgence, I thought. And
well, yeah, yeah. And I would like to point out that since his passing, a lot of podcasts are doing Bill Paxton tribute episodes. Phil and I actually were talking about Bill Paxton before he passed. Episode 53 of the Dark Discussions podcast, we did a Bill Paxton focus about the movie Frailty, which he directed and starred in. And we, I think both of us were actually hoping that he would direct some more movies, because we both like Frailty so much. But unfortunately, I guess it wasn't to be.
Yeah, and we did that episode like 4 years ago, Eric.
Yeah.
Yeah, still available, too.
I was actually very happy to hear, I do listen to a lot of number of political podcasts, and I won't say the ones because I don't want to get into politics here, but several brought up Bill Paxton, and I was very, very pleasantly surprised that they all brought up Frailty. So I was expecting, you know, to bring up Apollo 13 or Aliens, but, you know, given that Frailty is, you know, I don't think it had a theatrical release, not a real one.
Well, yeah, I was going to say.
I saw it in the theater.
You did?
I saw Frailty in the theater, yeah. I loved it. It's one of my favorite movies. Thank you for posting that, Phil, the other day on Sunday when I mentioned it. I was going to post it for everybody because you guys did such a great job on that episode. But yeah, I saw it when it came out in the theater. I was dating a guy in New Jersey, and their theater near his house got it. So,
wow,
and then the second
cool.
It was out on DVD, I got it. It's an amazing movie. I mean, it's just really rich and deep and intelligent, and it's amazing. It's so good.
I agree with all of that. And like Mike was saying, I've actually been also pleasantly surprised to see Frailty getting some love and mentions of Bill Paxton's movies, because it's not one of the obvious ones like Titanic or Aliens. So I'm happy that it's getting some appreciation.
And another one, and I'm blanking on the title now, was the Sam Raimi film, A Simple Plan.
Simple Plan.
Oh, my God. He was awesome in that, yeah.
That movie is great.
Yeah. Well, that was the thing about Bill Paxton.
Yeah, like, I haven't seen that movie in ages. I should pull that out.
The thing that was pretty cool about – I saw that Simple Plan actually at the theaters. Similar theme of an ex-girlfriend. But I have to say that it's curious is that he came up through the Roger Corman School, and was good friends with James Cameron and all these other folk. And then he became a leading man for about a 6-year period, which included Simple Plan, Apollo 13, Twister, and so forth. And then as his as he aged and he wasn't getting the lead roles anymore, he fit in pretty good doing a lot of character roles and was able to survive. And oddly, or I shouldn't say oddly, but interestingly, as Eric mentioned, he was obviously a talent more than just an actor, yet he just wasn't prolific, because based off of Frailty, even though he didn't write it, he directed a pretty damn good film and co-starred in it, that he showed that he was an apt person behind the film, the camera, as well as in front of the camera.
Right. One of the most impressive things about Frailty is that he got fantastic performances out of the child actors. Yes, casting is a big part of that, but directing is also no small part of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was one of the Matthew McConaughey's first roles that got him noticed in
it
Hollywood.
The beginning of the McConaissance.
Yeah, exactly. Because they were both from Texas. Paxton and McConaughey, so they were buddies, and then after that, McConaughey's career kind of skyrocketed, faded just a bit, and then skyrocketed again with his resurgence with his Academy Award a couple of years ago and True Detective. But yeah, it was a terrible loss. My last role seeing him in was Edge of Tomorrow. That no matter how great that film was, both starring Tom Cruise and Emily Blunt, as well as directed by one of my favorite directors, Doug Liman, the role of Bill Paxton was one of the roles that really shined in that film for me. So it was amazingly surprising that he passed. Any further thoughts, Abe? Any Bill Paxton moments?
I just remember him fondly from Aliens and Predator 2. You know, I thought he was fantastic in those, and you know, he had such an energy, and it just sucks that he's gone. I mean, it's just another notch of this growing list of lost great actors that's been permeating. Since 2016. So, you know, rest in peace, Bill Paxton, and thanks for everything.
Yep, and he has one of the greatest lines in any horror film ever, which came back to back with another great line. The line was "Game over, man, game over" in Aliens, and then right after that, the most famous line of the film was "They mostly come at night, mostly." And but either way, 61. Any other news? Anyone?
Nope.
All right, so first off, we got a new Terror Tantrum. That's right, Patrick Lacey, author from New England. What he does is he does a segment on the podcast where he takes one of the boutique labels, such as Arrow or Criterion or Screen Factory or whatnot, and he reviews a release of an older film. So, for example, he tells whether the horror film is any good, and talks about the extras, but most importantly tells us all if the remastering of the film is right on to be the pricey boutique label that the film is released at $19.99 or whatever. Arrow is usually $24.99, but either way, let's hear the movie, what is the topic, and let's hear what he has to say.
And welcome to another edition of Terror Tantrums. My name is Patrick Lacey. I am a horror author and longtime listener to Dark Discussions. If you're new to the podcast, this is a segment where I take a look at a slightly lesser known or obscure horror film and hopefully give it an unbiased review, as usually I am seeing the film for the first time. That is, in fact, the case this week. This is Slaughterhouse, recently released through Vinegar Syndrome and directed by Rick Rossler. I'm probably saying that wrong. That is R-O-E-S-S-L-E-R. And from looking up his IMDb page, say that 10 times fast, looks like this is the only film he has directed, although he had some production credits in other films that I wasn't familiar with. So this is Slaughterhouse. I'll read you the back cover copy. It's pretty decent, and we'll get right into it. Lester Bacon's Slaughterhouse, you heard that right, Bacon, has run into financial problems. Faced with the town lawyer, the sheriff, and the rival slaughterhouse owner trying to purchase his land, Lester decides to take matters into his own hands. After discovering the type of violence his hulking and mentally deranged son, Buddy, is capable of, Lester orders him to permanently dispose of anyone who conspires against them. .. And then if we go one paragraph down, it says, a late 80s video store staple, Rick Rossler's Slaughterhouse is a gleefully bloody San Diego shot slasher film featuring atmospheric and noirish cinematography along with a generous helping of creative kills. I just want to – usually I only read like the actual summary of the film, but I think that it plays into this week's review because this isn't it's not actually really a slasher film at all, I guess it has slasher elements, but what sets this apart and makes it sort of unique is the way it's shot. You can tell that the filmmakers actually took it very seriously. We'll get into it in a little bit. It's kind of a horror comedy, but they're taking it seriously. They have a lot of cool shots, and it is atmospheric. When they go to the slaughterhouse, you know, the lighting is very dim. It's very interesting looking. There's a lot of mist that sort of makes the scenes look extra interesting as well. And, it does have this noir vibe because – this isn't a straight up, like, Buddy is killing people, but it's really Lester who's the mastermind behind it, and he's using Buddy as kind of his, like, right-hand man, sort of like a henchman thing. So almost reminds me of a noir in that case, or a crime movie, but also, like, almost like a superhero movie, because Lester comes across as very maniacal and very supervillain-esque, and then you have sort of his mindless henchman, for lack of a better term. But this movie is great. If you've heard past episodes of Terror Transforms, I've reviewed a handful of Vinegar Syndrome movies, and they're not always my favorite. Things like Frightmare and Don't Go Into the Woods Alone. Those are films that I think do deserve to be kind of unearthed, and that's why I absolutely love Vinegar Syndrome for that. But with that said, I haven't really seen a Vinegar Syndrome film up until now, aside from Jack Frost, but I saw that in the theater and reviewed sort of the theatrical experience that really resonated with me. Yet I always go back to them because I'm just so interested in these films, because you're not going to get these anywhere else. A lot of these things didn't even make it to DVD. Although Slaughterhouse did, I believe. But so I picked this up at the Vinegar Syndrome booth at TerrorCon last weekend, as of this recording, where I had a booth with fellow horror authors Adam Caesar and Matt Serafini. So I had heard a lot about this film. I figured I'd give it another try. I didn't necessarily have the highest expectations just because of past viewings of Vinegar Syndrome movies. I don't know if it was sort of those low expectations or if this is just a great film, but it was wonderful. I can't tell you how much I enjoyed this film. And as I mentioned earlier, it is the way it's shot, and it is the way that the filmmakers take it seriously. But it's also just the movie itself. It has this comedic tone, but it's not a so bad it's good film. This comedy is deliberate. A lot of these montages that they have, I don't really want to spoil it, but there's plenty of these montages where the teens are sort of running around town, kind of causing havoc. They're done deliberately. They're done in a style that makes this film seem much more modern than its release date, which is 1987. And the transfer doesn't hurt much either, because the transfer, they really cleaned it up and it looks nice and crisp and clean. And yeah, it doesn't seem like it's 1987. This film is kind of ahead of its time in terms of horror comedies. And I would liken it, I mean, the most obvious thing is sort of Motel Hell, because you're dealing with pigs and sort of slaughtering. I don't know. Motel Hell is a little bit goofier, but I might give the edge to this. I'd have to see both. Again, I'd have to let this one simmer, but I highly enjoyed this. And as it says in the back, too, the kills are quite creative. I don't want to give any of them away, because they're really good. There's one scene where – I mean, I will give this away, but Buddy dresses as a cop because he's killed a cop. And so he puts on the cop's uniform, which is about like 30 times too small for him. And he kind of chases this girl down, and the kill that he does there is absolutely excellent. So I don't know. I've just taken off guard, because, like I said, the past couple movies I've seen from Vinegar Syndrome didn't really wow me, though I respected them as films in and of themselves. But this one, it had that I want to watch it again immediately after watching it, and that can't get too much more complimentary than that. There's a lot of special features. I didn't go too deep into them, but we have commentary tracks, we have interviews, little production sort of featurettes, all that, and a shooting script gallery. So that looks like it's not exactly a still gallery. I wonder if that would be interesting. I'll check that out. But yeah, I probably checked 3 out of these 15 features, so I do need to go deeper into those. But yeah, Vinegar Syndrome, it's chocked full of extras, and I think a little bit more extras than their usual releases, if I'm not mistaken. But yeah, I'm going to have to check out more of Vinegar Syndrome's catalog, because this one blew me away. If you like 80s slashers, just with the caveat that this isn't a straight-up slasher, a lot of it is from the point of view of the killers, then this will be right up your alley. If you like video rental staples, as it says in the back of this box here, you'll like this. If you like horror comedies that are taken seriously, you'll like this. And especially if you like very creative kills, this will be right up your alley. Yeah, I'm going to give it an A this week. Not a perfect film, but damn near close. I very, very much enjoyed it. That is Slaughterhouse, directed by Rick Ross, and that is from Vinegar Syndrome. Check Vinegar Syndrome out and check out this movie if any of that sounds up your alley. That's really all I have to talk about this week. Yeah, it's a great film. I don't really have too many complaints, and that's always a good thing. One more thing I do want to bring up for shameless self-promotion reasons. As I mentioned in the beginning of the segment, as always, I am a horror author, and I have a novel coming out April 15th, so that's about just over a month as of this recording, through Sinister Grin Press. I have the word vinegar on my mind for obvious reasons. It's called We Came Back, and it's sort of a teenage cult coming-of-age novel with monsters and other dimensional beings and all sorts of fun stuff. So if you like my reviews, if you like the movies I've reviewed, I think you'll like We Came Back because there's a little bit of comedy, a very black comedy. And there's, I would like to think, some creative kills. But if any of the films that I've been reviewing are an indication, I think they'll be in your wheelhouse if you like them. So if you are interested in checking that out, that will be out in paperback and ebook through, as I said, Sinister Grin Press. You can get it on Amazon or BarnesandNoble.com, and that will be April 15th. But that is enough of me yammering, as always. If you have a suggestion for a slightly lesser-known or obscure horror film, hit the guys up on the Facebook group or shoot them an email at darkdiscussions@AOL.com if I haven't seen the film. Or maybe even if I have, I will add it to the ever-growing stockpile of movies that I'm going to be reviewing in the near future. But that's all I got. As always, thanks for listening, and I will see you guys next week. Take care.
All right, so we're back. Thank you once again to Patrick Lacy. And you'll have another Tar Tatcher next week for folks who are interested. And as he states in his review, contact darkdiscussions@AOL.com for any suggested boutique label releases for him to review. So I think with all that, I think we can probably get into our film tonight. And Abe, why don't you explain all this about this film before we even say what the film is? Why are we doing this film?
Because Eric's car broke down.
Well, we'll explain that in a moment, but go ahead.
All right. So basically, a while back, we had a poll in which we have certain films chosen by us that we would have our followers vote on. And by the end of a certain period of time, we would, whatever film had most votes, we would view. We would do an episode on. But it came down to a tie between this film and another film. And so this film's been on the back burner, consider how many films we've been had been taken care of since last year and so far these few months. And now just the time it's come around that we would finally get a chance to talk about it.
Yep, that's true. And Mike, me and you and Chrissy last week were discussing whether we were going to do Get Out or The Girl with All the Gifts this week, but and we chose that we were going to do Get Out, but something occurred. Eric, what happened to make us push it back?
Yeah, well, first of all, before Mike gives me any more shit, I did encourage you to go ahead and talk about Get Out without me.
True,
that was not the choices was made. So stop giving me shit, Mike.
I didn't give you any shit. I just said what happened.
That's actually not what happened. I'll explain what did happen. What happened is that I have a detached garage, and my car was in the garage. And when I went to open my garage door, one of the cables on my garage door opener snapped, thus jamming the door in the frame.
Shit.
Yeah, so I had to call somebody to come out the next morning. It took about 20 minutes with a pry bar and a 2x4 to get his head under the garage to find out what the hell was going on. And then he was able to fix it from there. So it wasn't actually a car malfunction. It was an inability to access my car.
And it was surprising that I found out, Eric. And it's kind of scary because if you were inside the garage and this happened, Eric's garage only has the large door that rolls up and down. He doesn't have a little side door to get out or get in.
That is true. But if I'd been in the garage, then I would have been able to see and clear the broken cable. From the outside, I couldn't even tell why the door wasn't opening. So
I just want to point out, if this happened in a horror movie, Phil would be the first one saying, who the hell ever heard of a garage without a side door? He would never be trapped in there.
You're absolutely right.
I've had to explain it to several people. Like, well, why don't you just go in from the house? I'm like, no. It's a detached garage, and it's in a row of detached garages. So on either side of the garage is another garage.
But you're right, Mike. Good catch there. I would most certainly be complaining and flipping out about that. But no matter, because Get Out we're going to be doing sooner or later anyway. However, this film is considered basically a classic in a sense. So this may be actually a good thing that we're fitting it in. Go ahead, Eric.
I was just going to say, you guys told me to watch Jason and the Astronauts, but I couldn't find that, so I just watched Jason X. Is that cool?
Yeah, that should work.
All right. Close enough.
So either way, I guess since this was your choice, Abe, we'll do something a little different here. Abe, what's the film we're going to discuss tonight?
Tonight, we will be talking about the 1963 stop-motion classic film from the mind of Ray Harryhausen, Jason and the Argonauts.
Jason and the Argonauts, the classic story of an epic voyage that has been told and retold since the birth of Western civilization, now presented on the screen for the first time.
Pull! Pull! Do your hearts crack and your backs break?
Jason and his band of Argonauts, the mightiest warriors the world of adventure has ever known, in search of the fabulous magic golden fleece.
Where will you find this miracle?
I have heard there is a tree at the end of the world with a fleece of gold hanging in its branches.
Here is the magnificent excitement of that legendary time when men like gods and gods like men lived and loved violently. Todd Armstrong and Nancy Kovac portray the classic lovers. Jason, the man who challenges the gods. Medea, who betrays a kingdom for love. Acastus, driven by a lust for power. Hera, goddess and woman, who defies the might of Zeus, king of the gods, who unleashes his fury at rebellious mortals. The Argonauts, caught in the clutches of the towering bronze giant Talos. The Argonauts, battling vulturous harpies. Jason, threatened by the seven-headed Hydra. Medea, the temple dancer. Mysterious, exciting, and exotic. Jason, battling the army of skeletons.
Kill, kill, kill them all!
One man defying a universe of mortal and immortal danger. Jason and the Argonauts. A search that became a legend.
That's right. Jason and Argonauts, like Abe said, is a 1963 film. The interesting thing is that it's a Ray Harryhausen film, so that's why this is a Ray Harryhausen focus episode. And usually, no matter who wrote, directed, or starred in it, it was always a Ray Harryhausen production. He was one of the lucky few in Hollywood. And especially in lower budget films to actually have full control over all his films. So good for him. The film stars a number of, character actors of its time. A lot of folks that people know, from television and whatnot. But before we get into some of the actors, obviously it's stop motion, photography was by, Ray Harryhausen. The creatures, and so forth. Folks may know that Ray Harryhausen was good friends with Ray Bradbury as children, and they were best friends, or pretty close to it, till their past. Yes, Mike?
I'm just... It saddens me, and I think I might have to say this, but... Abe, since you're of that generation, if there's any younger listeners out there who don't know who Ray Harryhausen is, Abe, who is Ray Harryhausen?
Ray Harryhausen is a stop-motion pioneer. He sadly passed away in 2013, but he lived a full life bringing incredible creatures through stop-motion animation to life. He's known for films such as The Seven Voyages of Sinbad. In fact, all three Sinbad films of that era, Clash of the Titans, the Mysterious Island film, The Valley of Guanji. He not only brought incredible creations to life, but he inspired a new generation of filmmakers. And so if you don't know who Ray Harryhausen is, interested in film or animation or anything like that, you have to look into this guy because his work is astounding, and it still remains so to this day.
Yeah, that's true. A couple of things about him that Abe forgot to mention, or just one other thing that he forgot to mention, was he got into a lot of fantasy films in the 60s and 70s, but prior to that, in the 50s, he was one of the leaders of science fiction films and giant monster films of the 50s. So a number of films such as The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms.
It Came from Beneath the Sea.
Yeah.
Earth versus the Flying Saucers, 20 Million Miles to Earth.
Yep,
10,000 exactly. BC.
Yep.
Yeah.
A very important thing, too, is that he was actually inspired by one of the oldest stop-motion films, a major film classic Hollywood, King Kong, which is what inspired him to start his own work when he was very young.
He actually, Willis H. O'Brien, the guy that did King Kong, was actually his mentor. Yeah, that is correct. Now, further on this film, this is truly a Ray Harryhausen film for all the folks that worked on it. The director, Don Chaffee, did 1 Million Years B.C., which was another Ray Harryhausen film. Yeah, as well as a lot of TV work. Producer was Charles H. Schneer, who co-produced pretty much every film with Ray Harryhausen. The screenwriter, Beverly Cross is actually a man, Alan Beverly Cross. Used to be an English playwright, but he wrote Clash of the Titans, another Ray Harryhausen film. Cinematographer did Seven Voyages of Sinbad, First Men in the Moon, other Ray Harryhausen films. And his name was Wilkie Cooper. Maurice Roots was the editor, another man that worked on films for him, including First Men in the Moon. And, of course, Bernard Herrmann, who did the music for this film and did the music for two or three other Ray Harryhausen films. And interestingly, this film produced, but has two Academy Award winners, including Ray Harryhausen as a Lifetime Achievement Award, Academy Award, and then, of course, Bernard Herrmann, who also has Academy Award. So some Hollywood power in that sense. Anybody else wanted to bring up anything about Ray Harryhausen or any of this before we go around?
If you want to learn more about Harryhausen, I haven't watched it. I've heard great things about it, but I just discovered they made a documentary about Harryhausen recently, and that is available on Amazon Prime. So if you're a Prime member, you can watch it for free. So that might be something worth checking out.
There's also
some damn good, hour length documentaries on all of his movies, those discs. If you buy their discs, the DVD, there's a documentaries, hour documentaries on there about him as well. Eric, you going to say something?
Yes, that's actually part of what I was going to say. I was going to say, first of all, this movie really isn't my bag. This is not my kind of thing. But I will say that watching this movie gave me appreciation for Ray Harryhausen's place in history as a stop motion animator, because what he managed to do back in the day was pretty amazing. And also, I did watch that documentary on the disc. It's like feature length, and it's narrated by Leonard Nimoy, who sadly has also passed. And it has interviews with Harryhausen as well as Ray Bradbury, about his career. So it's, if you want to know more about him, that's a great way to do it too.
Eric, did you ever, have you seen any of his other films?
Clash of the Titans and probably something else, but that's the one I remember.
Did you like that one, Clash of Titans?
Yeah, it's fine. I didn't see it when it came out. So I know a lot of people have a lot of nostalgia for that movie, and I don't, but I still enjoyed watching it. You know, I particularly enjoyed the Pegasus. I thought that was pretty cool.
Okay.
I also have a pretty cool book that you, if anyone's interested in reading, it's called Ray Harryhausen Anime Life, which is written by Ray Harryhausen and Tony Dalton, which chronicles his career and everything he did from his films and beyond, which is available. So if people are interested in reading up on it, that's something else to check out as well.
Abe, what year did that book come out?
2004.
Okay, I was going to say, because I actually met Ray Harryhausen. There was a big event at Lincoln Center, and we went down and we watched The Seventh Voyage of Sinbad. And I don't remember what the other movie was. It might have been Jason and the Argonauts. I'd have to look at my records. But I did get him to sign my copy of Clash of the Titans. And I think that was a release event for that book.
That's awesome.
I need to find my picture. There's a picture of me with him. And I need to find it so I can put it up on the
Dark Discussions
page. Oh, my God. He was so nice. And, like, I couldn't even really talk. I was like, I loved Beast from 20,000 Fathoms. You know, I'm, like, five, you know. I regressed to five. And that monster scared me. And I loved Clash of the Titans. And he puts his hand on top of mine and he goes, that's okay. Did I make a lot of scary monsters? Were you scared because of me? And I said, yes. And he says, oh, I didn't mean to do that. He was very elderly at the time, of course. But he was just the nicest person. And my God, he had a line out the door. And let me tell you, he took his time talking to everyone. And this was not one of these things like at a con where you pay $25. Do you know what I mean? To get his signature or his photo. This was, he was there at the event. You could talk to him in between the movies at the intermissions. And then you waited in line, and everybody that was there got a chance to talk to him if they wanted.
Very cool. Now, Mike.
This is so cool.
Mike, what's your opinion on – I mean, Eric said that, you know, he doesn't have the nostalgia. He didn't follow him. But I know you did, because me and you discussed possibly doing a Ray Harryhausen retrospective way back when the podcast first started. And then later we almost did a four-movie – episode as well. So I know you're a big fan of him. Explain why and all that stuff.
Well, you know, I said I was always a monster kid. I love creatures, and you know, growing up in the 70s, there weren't a whole lot of monster options that weren't Ray Harryhausen or Godzilla. That was, it was either rubber suits or stop motion. And nobody really did it as well. If you wanted dinosaurs, you had 1 million BC and you had Valley of Guanji. If you you know, wanted me, you know, fantasy stuff, there's all the Sinbad movies and Jason the Argonauts. You had, you know, Mysterious Island is the adaptation of the Jules Verne novel. You know, and his roots go back to King Kong. So if you were a nerd growing up when we did, you had to know who Harryhausen was. It would be like not knowing who George Lucas is today.
Yeah, and most of those movies, Mike, at that time when you and I were growing up, were like 20 years old.
Or some even less.
Or I mean,
I mean, Sinbad and the Eye of the Tiger and...
Yeah, the last two Sinbads were when we were like in elementary school.
Yeah.
Clash of Titans was when we were nine and Chrissy was eight.
Yeah, I mean, Sinbad and Clash of the Titans were out in theaters. when I was a kid, and so they weren't that. I mean, they kind of felt old because they were. I know they were. A lot of them were made before I was born. You know, but they. I think they don't necessarily age in the best way now. In some ways, the special effects are still pretty. I should say the stop motion effects are still pretty damn impressive. Some of the optical stuff is really, really aged not so well in terms of compositing and things like that. But those are just the limitations of the time. And it's really just the Harryhausen work. That's who you watch for. And you don't, for the most part, you don't watch for the acting and you don't watch for the script or the direct. You watch for the monsters. You, or at least that's what I did.
Well, I would say two things, Mike. Yeah, the monsters were absolutely awesome. When I was a kid, the Sinbad films were like some of my favorite. At the time, I had no idea who Ray Harryhausen was, and I didn't even know that he did all of them, to be honest. But I enjoyed them a lot. And Crash of the Titans was one, as well as the Sinbad films that were always played over and over on HBO when in its heyday. Not heyday, but in its infancy. So yeah, you're right. There was other reasons some people, older folks than me and you, Mike, when we were kids. I mean, they had some pretty hot chicks in the Sinbad films and whatever. But those things, obviously, when I was 8 or 9, all that mattered to me was the monsters. One thing I wanted to bring up is that 1 million years BC, and when dinosaurs ruled the Earth, which is its follow up film. Dinosaurs Ruled the Earth was actually by a someone that was mentored by Ray Harryhausen, but 1 million years BC was by Ray Harryhausen. Those have just been released this past 2 weeks on Blu-ray. So folks who are interested, some of his work is now coming to Blu-ray. Now, Abe, why are you a big fan of Ray Harryhausen's? Because you've been mentioning this for a while.
Yeah, well, I see, when I was very little, the very first one of the first films that made the biggest impression on me was The Seven Voyages of Sinbad. And I watched that film so many times. I loved it. It got me so into fantasy, and from there I started grabbing every other film like it that I could get my hands on. The Golden Voyage of Sinbad, Sinbad and the Eye of the Tiger, Jason and the Argonauts, Clash of the Titans. And from there it just exploded into just the genre in general, like how Godzilla got me into the kaiju scene, or how Pumpkinhead got me into horror. Ray Harryhausen was a major influence on my life and what made me love imaginative worlds of film. So this is why, and because the film, the reason I chose this one, not the same, was Sinbad, because, well, Harryhausen himself considered this film his best work, and I thought, you know, what better way to, you know, finally give him that tribute that we meant to do so when he passed away several years ago, than to showcase a film that he was most proud of.
Now, Chrissy, what's your favorite Ray Harryhausen film?
That's a tough one. I fell in love with Beast from 20,000 Fathoms when I was really young. That movie made an impression on me. I didn't sleep for weeks. And then the next one that I saw that really made an impression on me was the Sinbad movie, The Seventh Voyage of Sinbad. And then the next one, of course, was Clash of the Titans. And that made a huge impression on me because I was right around that age where, we were in middle school, and of course all our parents let us go to the theater to see it. And because also we were studying Greek mythology at that time in school. So, you know, when Clash of the Titans came out, it was like a big thing. It was very exciting. And, oh, we get to go and learn about mythology, even though the story was different. The stories were warped a little bit. And of course you had Harry Hamlin in there and he was the hero. So that was always my, experience with Harryhausen. And, and I forgot to mention Mysterious Island, which I actually didn't see until I was older, but my father had the movie tie-in version for Mysterious Island, which I read, and I own it now, so I should photograph that and put it up on Dark Discussions too. And it had the picture of the men fighting like the giant crab on the beach. And so that really fascinated me. And I just remember sitting in my room staring at that cover for hours. It just fascinated me. So that was my experience with Harryhausen. He was definitely integral to my childhood, like the rest of you guys. I was a monster fan. I loved Godzilla. Anything with creatures, especially big, scary creatures, I was into. So I guess it just kind of came natural that Harryhausen would be so integral in my development.
Mike, what's your favorite Harryhausen film?
I'm trying to, probably the ones I saw the most were the two last ones, because I had...
Oh, Sinbad and Eye of the Tiger.
Eye of the Tiger and Clash of the Titans. And yeah. I probably like Eye of the Tiger a little bit more in retrospect. I don't know why. Obviously had some fantastic work with specifically the Medusa and Clash of the Titans. But it's just, my father was working in video editing, and so we actually had a business size VCR tape player from way before anyone had VHS. And so he would get bootlegs of movies, would get passed around the office, and he would bring them home, and one of them was Eye of the Tiger. So that was in my house when I was growing up, and I could watch that anytime I wanted to on these massive videotapes. They were like 3/4-inch tapes instead of the half-inch tapes that you'd get from normal VHS. But they only had an hour of footage on it, so you'd have to switch it out in the middle. But so I'd watch that one quite a lot, and that's very well ingrained in my memory and had just dripping with nostalgia. It's really hard for me to watch it as an objective film. And I wrote several years ago, I was participating in something on Unnatural Selections, where it's a monster-themed week, and a number of bloggers had just pledged to write like something every day, monster-related. And so I had written one article on for Ray, because that was right after he passed, was in, and I listed all my favorite creatures that Ray Harryhausen had done. And a lot of them came from Eye of the Tiger. So that's probably the one that I like the most.
Now, Mike, that's my second favorite. My first favorite is Sinbad, the Golden Voyage of Sinbad with the Kali attack and all that. Do you have that? What?
No, I was just trying to. I always get those two confused. I don't know why.
Yeah, that's the one. Which one is which? I remember by the leading lady. So that was Carolyn Monroe. The one you like is the one with Jane Seymour.
No, the ones I know Eye of the Tiger. It's the Golden Voyage versus Seventh Voyage of Sinbad. Those are the two I always confuse.
Okay. Yeah, the Rukali one was the second one, the seven. The Golden Voyage of Sinbad.
Yep.
Yeah. Now, Mike, do you have the Medusa a picture on your wall somewhere? The one I got you?
Oh, yeah. That's up in my office.
Oh, okay. Very good. Very good. Now, Abe, what's your favorite? Just the title before, so we can get into the movie, because I'm sure Eric's getting sick of our nostalgia and working with Ray Harryhausen. What's your favorite?
That's a tough one. That's my tough one. But I think Seventh Voyage, mainly because of its influence on me. And I still have signed a film of View Glass, even now.
Okay. So the Seventh Voyage of Sinbad was the first one from 1958. The one I like best is The Golden Voyage of Sinbad, which was 1973, and Mike's favorite is Sinbad and the Eye of the Tiger, which was 1977. So, and Chris,
I just bought Beast from 20,000 Fathoms.
Oh, nice! Is that on Blu-ray yet?
It's on Blu-ray, and it's got extra features.
Yeah, a lot of them do now. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't even think I'm still watching that thing on my old videotape. Actually, believe it or not.
Oh wow.
I watched Jason on DVD. I've got two box sets for Harryhausen. Yeah. One is his science fiction films, one is his fantasy films.
Yep.
But I got to be honest, it was a little hard on my eyes watching on my big screen on DVD. It wasn't a great remaster. So I understand the Blu-ray remaster is much, much better. So I may have to invest.
Yeah, I know
the version I actually watched, Mike, and it's pretty good.
Oh, the Blu-ray? Oh, nice.
Yeah, I'm actually one of the three people that still has disc service through Netflix, so that's how I got that movie to watch.
They keep trying to sell me on it.
Yeah.
They're like, join Eric. and Bob and Julie, you could be the fourth person to still get this from Netflix.
There you go. All right, so let's do a roundtable, our opinion of this film from 1963, Jason and the Argonauts. So we'll start with you, Abe.
I think this film is pretty awesome from technical standpoints. It definitely has the it's a sort of standard film that's really brought up to an epic level of a high seas voyage to uncharted worlds. And while the cast is not anything that's mind blowing in terms of the characters, the real stars are his Ray Harryhausen's creatures, which are all fantastic. I love the bronze giant Talos. I love the skeletons, the Hydra. The scene with the clashing rocks was pretty awesome. It's a great adventure film, and I think it's not accurate to the story of the legend. So if you're interested in the legend and its accuracy, you may have to read it up there because of great deviations from there. But if you are just going to just look see it's a fun film, it's definitely a blast. There was a lot of hard work put into this into several scenes in order to bring out set pieces, battle sequences with some of the creatures. It was a complicated film to create among all the other films that Harryhausen had make. I definitely can see why Harryhausen was so proud of it, and I really do like this film a lot. While it's not my all-time favorite Harryhausen film, I still think it's a blast.
All right, very good. What about you, Mike?
I'm going to echo a lot of Abe's sentiments. It's not like the acting didn't necessarily blow me away, although I actually really liked the guy they had playing Hercules. The guy who played Zeus just felt to me more like, the neighbor who has to borrow the lawnmower. even as a kid, because I was really into Greek myth, I would always be a little irritated at how much they changed the myth for the movie, because I was a purist even then. But, a lot of ways they streamline the storyline, and this is very old school storytelling. They don't linger on a lot of plot stuff. There's a lot of exposition and it hurdles along very quickly from, point A to B to C, just to hit all the main plot points of the myth. It's, everyone knows this is back when they would actually teach us crap in school, as Christy had said. And, you were expected to know who Argo was and all this other, all this other stuff. And so they said, okay, we have to hit all the highlights of the Jason story. And, even if it doesn't really work in a narrative sense. And I never thought there's the crushing rock scene that never really worked for me with Triton. And really for me, this is all about get to the end, get to the Hydra, get to the skeletons.
It's interesting you say that, Mike, because my favorite monster was the bronze statue, Talos.
Oh, well, he's early on. So he's like your first one. You're like, all right. And then there's this, you have the heartbeat scene, which is okay. And then you got to wait and go through the whole really, but I just don't like the crushing rock scene. Just drags for me. And, so it could be lose a little bit of work. It is, again, old school storytelling. If you can't watch old movies, Eric, Eric, you can watch old movies. This type I don't think is your flavor. Then you're not going to enjoy it as much. And you really have to watch it with an eye towards the effects. And I can understand why Harryhausen, loved this film so much as far as his personal best, because he's involved far more with the effects work than he is with the storytelling and the directing. He's just doing the effects work. And you look at the skeletons in particular and the Hydra, and even with Talos, it's, the interview I saw with him and, it's on the disc. He's being interviewed by John Landis. He points out that he had to work hard to make Talos jerky. And some people actually complained about how jerky he was with stop motion, or was trying to make it smooth because it's naturally jerky, but he had to kind of step back so you could get that sound of, when he had the effect in later of the sound of the metal, stressing against metal and the movement and the mechanical nature of the character. And Talos is one of my favorite Harryhausen creatures. I think I rated it number two in my article. But you look at the technical design of the Hydra, and one of the things he points out was how you're in the middle of animating all these seven heads, and then you stop and you go get a lunch break, and you can't remember, was this head moving backwards or was it moving forwards? Because you didn't have it all captured on computer to just reference back to or anything like that. So you had to keep track of everything meticulously. So, and I imagine it was even that much harder when you did a similar thing with Medusa in Clash of the Titans, having to animate the hair.
But, yeah, so, yeah, it's Cali with all the arms.
Yeah, so so from a technical field, I understand why he was so happy about it. From a storytelling point of view, I'm okay. You know, you have that romance where the lead falls in love with leading lady falls in love with the leading man because they saw each other and that's all they needed, and they knew they had to be in love and story to work.
Well, oddly, that's how the mythos that it comes from is kind of sort of like that anyway. So I can't really fault them for that, because that is actually fairly accurate to the tale.
So, I mean, look, that's how they did those stories back then, and this is mostly made for young boys, was where the films were aimed. And they weren't really looking for a mushy love story anyway.
Apollonius was the original author, from way back, 3 BC, 3rd BC, or whatever.
So, all right, so that's my take.
All right, very good. Chrissy, what about yourself?
I had forgotten how much I enjoy the Harryhausen films and just this simple kind of straightforward storytelling. It was just really nice to just sit there and watch a movie and not really think about anything and just be entertained. I really enjoyed the dated kind of 60s corn, you know, the fun-loving jolly Hercules, and oh ha ha, let's all laugh at the first Olympic Games, and you know, and of course, you know, and then they're all manly men shining with their tans and their hairy manly chests, running around in diapers, you know, and of course, it's true. It looked like diapers, totally. Hercules especially looked like a big diaper from the back. And then, of course, Medea saying, I have no country now and I love you. Like, okay, you know.
She still totally had a country. Yeah,
she still totally did, but whatever.
But she had to flee.
I think also I'd forgotten how many creepy, unsettling moments were in this film, and I think Harryhausen film in general, they were the stuff, as I'd mentioned earlier, of my early nightmares, and I can see why. You know, a little kid, a 6 or 7 year old, Talos is creepy, the way he moves, and in fact, I have a comment about that later that's kind of interesting. But yeah, I just completely enjoyed it. I really loved this movie, and it was just so nice. It was like having coffee with an old friend when I sat down to watch it.
Yeah, very good. For me, I enjoyed this film a whole lot. I don't like it as much as some of his films because of the story, because it ends awkwardly. I think if they had just wrote the screenplay as Jason going after this treasure of the fleece, that would have had a better ending, but it's almost set up for a part two that never occurs. And
that's actually true, Phil. It's in the IMDb trivia.
Okay, all right.
He chose to do the Sinbad movies instead.
Oh, okay, all right. And as a result, I always felt a little empty at the end because it just ends. However, from beginning to that unfortunate no ending, it's pretty damn good. The Talos scene is arguably one of the best horror or monster scenes from my childhood, and it still holds up today. I love how it has no expression because it's a statue that's alive, and it has no pupils and things like that. So it really is creepy, as Chrissy said. And the skeletons are always pointed out as a technical marvel by film critics and historian, film historians. And I believe that Harry Hawson in that documentary discusses it fairly well, Mike. But all in all, a strong film in genre, both historically as well as today, because if I plop this in for my nephew, he would probably go crazy over it like he does Guardians of the Galaxy or Star Wars. Or he would if I put in a Godzilla film from 1970 or something. So there's a lot of films that, like this one, that could still play for young kids and would be a great film to start, folks, especially for if you like fantasy. Chris, you going to say something?
I was, actually. I forgot to mention that, you know, since you mentioned the effects as well, it was really amazing to me to sit there and watch something and actually have that young kind of amazement, like, how did they do that? Because nowadays, when we see any kind of special effect in a film, that wonder's gone. You just go, oh yeah, they did that in a computer.
Right.
Yeah. And it was kind of fun to be like, holy crap, like, how did they do that? Like, you know, it's like they didn't have all this stuff.
So we're used to, like, I don't know, Beast from 20,000 Fathoms or Godzilla or King Kong, where most of the interaction is, you know, you close up of the actor. The actor goes, ah, and then you cut to the monster, you know, or they're on the same screen. You see this like a lot with Talos, and you just have the actor standing sort of where the foot comes down so that you could see the actor get squashed. And that's very minimal interaction, where with the skeletons, not only do you have these seven skeletons all on screen at the same time fighting, and he has to coordinate all of that in the motion, but, you know, you have to have the actors fighting invisible monsters that will be choreographed with the skeletons later, you know, and, you know, have to have the eye line right, and you have to have the motions of the swords right, where the swords connect with them, and so all that has to be incorporated, and they're being done apart from each other, and you don't have the, you know, computers available to sync them up, you know, so the actors, so you have the technical challenge of the acting first, and then that has to match up later with the performance of the stop motion, and so it's really, really impressive.
Yep, sure is. Eric, your first time hearing about this film and your opinions.
I'm going to echo a lot of what Mike has said. Because, you know, acting, story, this movie is really all about the Harryhausen work. And it is impressive. Like he was just talking about the skeletons. I was going to get into all that. But I was particularly, what was running through my head while I was watching that skeleton scene is just like 2-3 years ago, we got a scene in Game of Thrones with animated skeletons and some fighting. And they're using all that modern computer technology. And you know what? It didn't look marginally better than what Harryhausen did with his stop motion. It's really, really amazing what they were able to do with that scene, and particularly with I was amazed at how the choreography matched up with the stop motion. It was truly amazing. So I think it's worth watching just for that one scene alone.
And Eric, compared to the remake of Clash of the Titans, for example, you could argue that what we see here in Jason and Argonauts from 1963 is better than some of that computer graphic stuff from these remakes of Ray Harryhausen films.
I honestly the remake was so unmemorable, I don't recall.
I had actually forgotten about it until you just mentioned it.
Yeah, well, and it did well enough at the theaters even to.
I'm sorry, there was a remake of Jason?
No, Clash of the Titans. And then they had a follow up.
Oh yeah, I totally forgot about that. Yeah.
Yeah, and then they had a part two too, and which was interesting. All right, so I guess we can start discussing the film. So first off, Eric, why don't you give us the wiki?
Wiki. There's really not much to say here. The legendary Greek hero leads a team of intrepid adventurers in a perilous quest for the legendary Golden Fleece.
Pretty much to the point, yep.
Like Mike was talking about, the storytelling is really straightforward. And really, they just tell you, oh, this is going to happen, and then this is going to happen, and you have to go here and do this. And then they show them going there and doing that. So it really is breakneck pace storytelling with not a whole lot of complication going on.
Now, Abe, you were the one that mentioned that it doesn't follow the true story, but necessarily 100%. But this is an adaptation. But what is Jason and the story of the Golden Fleece?
All right. So Jason is the rightful heir to the throne of Thessaly, which was taken from him by Pelias. And in order to get it back, he needs to obtain the Golden Fleece, which is a magical item that is on the other side of the world in a place called Colchis. Which, in order to accomplish that, he gets a ship called the Argo, hence the name Argonauts, so the name of his men, and gathers a group of warriors of great skill to aid him on this long journey. Now, the adventures are very different, the way events unfold are as well, but the basic idea is that they must travel through these difficult obstacles to reach Colchis and get back to the fleece in order for Jason to become king of Thessaly.
All right, very good. All right, so I guess we can start discussing the film. We'll throw up the spoiler alert. The film is an odd film, right, Eric? Because it's not on VOD, right? Or if it is, you didn't bother because you have the Netflix where you can get the disc, right?
Right. Yeah, I just since I'm subscribed anyway, I just got the disc through Netflix. Although I think I seem to recall not being able to find it VOD.
Yeah, I think I remember that too. When we first discussed the film to do a couple of months ago, you mentioned that you couldn't find it necessarily for rent, it's for VOD, but you had this service anyway, and you didn't have to really pay for it because it's part of your monthly fee anyway. So you right. just went that route. But the disc is readily available everywhere. It's a Columbia release and is still treated with, as you can gather, a lot of respect from the production company. And it always is available. It's not like some regular genre films that are poo-pooed by these big companies. This is one of their films, or pretty much every Ray Harryhausen film is treated with utmost respect by these production companies, probably because they know they're still valuable commodities and do well with young audiences, though there's a lot to have for older audience as well. All right, so let's discuss the film. Mike, now you said you knew a lot about Jason and the Argonauts and the Golden Fleece and all that before?
Well, I really liked Greek mythology when I was a kid, so I read up a lot about it. And honestly, in the intervening years, I've let a lot of that knowledge slip by. So the little things that I might have gotten hung up on back then, I really can't get hung up. I don't even remember anymore. So that tells you the futility of nitpicking to that degree. But, so I remember the Argonaut, and it's the whole contest of champions, and only the best could sail on Argo, which was built by Argos, and, the story of the Harpies, and it's not the Hydra, which Hercules killed in one of his labors, but it was a dragon, and, the dragon's teeth you would sew, and you'd get soldiers that would spring up to attack. I don't remember if they were skeletal soldiers or not. So there's a lot of stuff that's there that's true to the narrative.
Yeah, no, they were fully armed warriors, but they were. I could find no mention of skeletons.
No.
Because like you, Mike, I forgot 95% of what I learned. So I actually pulled out my old Edith Hamilton and started reading up so that because I'd forgotten like almost all of it.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Yeah, it's hard because I remember some of the story as well, and it's kind of slipped my mind as well. But yeah, they were not skeleton warriors; they were kind of like armored, weird warriors that Jason didn't fight with alongside with some of his men, but instead tricked them into fighting each other.
Yeah, but Medea was the one that told him how to trick them.
Medea did help him in his trials in order to try to get the fleece. And the reason for the change from the dragon to the Hydra, as we see in the film, is because Raryhausen already did a dragon back when he did the Seven Voyages of Sinbad, wanted to try something different, so he chose the Hydra, which, interestingly enough, kind of works well with the narrative taking us to the skeleton creatures.
Yeah, it's true. Medea actually was the one that kills Talos in the original tale, and she was with them at that point. And
yeah, Talos occurs during the return journey instead of before they get to Colchis.
That's right. And also, Medea, unlike in the movie, was a powerful enchantress, which they only brush over a little bit in the movie. Yet in the story, she was a powerful enchantress, because her country follows Hecate. Hecate, which is the goddess of magic and such, and that actually is played up a lot in the film, which was good.
I think is funny is if you look up the Argonauts, on Wikipedia, they have a list of all 85 Argonauts.
Oh, so, interesting.
Oh, wow. So yeah, I mean that
there's supposed to be 85 of them.
There's supposed to be 85, and you know,
there was like 12 in this movie.
Yeah, yeah, I know.
They mentioned 40 men, but only maybe about 8 of them get any real focus, and the others are just red shirts.
Right. I just think it's funny that, you know, so many years later, there's a list of all 85 Argonauts, you know, as opposed to just, well, we know Jason and we know Hercules, and you know, we don't really give a crap about Melis or Mopsis. You know, they're there, and they all have their, and most of them have their an actor. One of them is actor, son of Hippus, and you know, all of them have their own Wikipedia page. So, you know, it's, you know, they're,
oh my god, some really awesome person put a lot of time into that.
Well, so really,
he's obviously very passionate about the Argonauts.
So in a way, it's almost like the Argonauts are like the original Avengers, you know, where all the Greek heroes come together for the grand quest to defeat Loki, you know, or the Golden Fleece. So that's kind of how that is if you compare it to a more modern modern mythology.
No, Eric. Oh, go on.
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, all right, well, Eric, let's talk about the big setup to the whole movie. What happens in the first, like, 10 minutes of the film to start the whole journey, I guess?
There's a dude. He's talking to another dude, and they're looking at ashes. And there's a prophecy dude, and he tells the other dude that he's going to get killed by a dude with one sandal. So he should kill all the children or something.
Dude.
So, in other words, it's basically a guy that wants to take over this kingdom, overthrow the king, and then marry this I guess the queen. But he's prophesied to, or Zeus wants him to do it, but then he's prophesied that he would eventually lose the kingdom from a man with one shoe or one sandal. And then what happens is they also tell him that the prophecy also says that the person with one shoe or one sandal will be the son of the murdered king. And so he decides to then kill all the children, which is two daughters and
the son. They don't say it's going to be the son. They say it's going to be the child, which is why he kills the daughters.
Yes.
Oh,
right. He was kind of upset about that.
Yeah, because he gets told right afterwards by Hera, who's disguised as a priestess, that it was only Jason who'd be the threat, which angers the usurper Pelias, that he just killed one of the daughters that needlessly, and he also learns that he cannot touch Jason because he's told, kill Jason and you kill yourself.
Right, right. So he has a lot of issues there, where he kills the mother and the two daughters.
Actually, no. Only one of the daughters. The other daughter cannot be is saved and brought somewhere else.
The and other daughter was the baby,
yep.
The infant. But they were sisters.
Yeah,
because she said, "Oh, this is my sister, whatever her name is."
Familia, and the one that was murdered was Bryce's.
Okay, it didn't matter because the only one that would be his threat was Jason, and yet he can't kill Jason because they said if you kill Jason, then you kill yourself somehow. It doesn't really
Which
explain
makes
how.
No fucking sense whatsoever.
Well, basically, the thing is, Zeus is the one who put everything in motion. He's pretty much orchestrating this entire series of events. Because when we see the gods actually on Olympus, sometimes we cut away from them. They're playing a game of chess. They are setting the series of events into motion, one move at a time, pretty much deciding the fate of whoever they deem worthy to obtain something or die. Because they do this to one of the Argonauts later on, Hylas.
True. And basically what happens is that Jason, when he does return, he actually saves the king, the new king, the usurper, from drowning. And then he finds out that it's Jason. So, okay, this is the guy that is going to possibly overthrow me. And so he sends him off to go after the Golden Fleece because he says the only way you're going to be able to take over the kingdom and get revenge is by getting the Golden Fleece, which is a mythical, magical item that gives power or something. Or you wear it and it's like magical armor.
It basically can cure famine, rid the land of plague, and even heal. So it's pretty much life-giving and very rejuvenating. And apparently, from what is told by Jason, the kingdom has really went to shit since Pelias took over. So Pelias hopes that this voyage be seemingly impossible would send Jason to the end of the world, and maybe he'll die in the process and never come back by the time that's
right. That's what I was going to say, because there's a good exposition moment that fits in perfectly, which is the usurper's son comes up to him and he goes, "Why did you let Jason go?" And then he explains, "Well, if I killed him, then I die too. But by having to do this trip, it sends him to the other side of the world," meaning like what Abe said, which is maybe he'll never come back, and are the issues solved, basically. So I don't have to kill him because I can't, but it also gets him out of the picture.
Yeah, but about half the Greeks...
I'm sorry, I was just going to say, he basically believes he's sending him off the edge of the earth and he won't have to worry about him anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah, about half the Greek myths start with a king gets a prophecy that someone's trying to kill him. And so he tries to avoid the prophecy and ends up creating, the conditions in which the prophecy comes true. There's always that no avoiding your fate, with Perseus, who they base Clash of the Titans on. The king finds out that his grandson is going to kill him. And so he doesn't want to kill his grandson because that would be bad juju. And so he sends him off and puts him in a box and with his mom and sets him a sail in the middle of the ocean. And thinking, well, it's not my fault they die. That would be Poseidon's fault. So he tries to get out of it that way. But then, of course, Perseus returns years later. And turns out that they get along really well. And he likes Grandpa. And they stage an Olympic event. And then Perseus throws his discus really hard and accidentally hits the king in the head and kills him.
Yeah, it's basically that the idea that your fate's been orchestrated by the gods and the fates as well. And any attempts to deviate from the path that was set for you is impossible. Basically, your life is chance and decided on. And, this also happens to Hercules, too, who, because his departure early on from the Argonauts is connected to Hylas' death.
Man, what a bunch of juju bullshit. The Greeks were a bunch of suckers.
Oh, read some of Aesop's fables. They had some really interesting notions.
Let's get into the journey, right? What happens is how he sets up the team of Argonauts, or people to go with him, or basically his future army, I guess. and the contests and all that. Chrissy, you were the one that mentioned about the first Olympics, right? Where this is how he chooses his army that's going to help fight.
Yeah, it was kind of the way that he delivered this idea to Zeus, like, I'm going to have games and I'm going to get the best, you know, warriors or people from all over Greece, the strongest men to participate in these games. And then, of course, we cut to like this montage of, you know, throwing discuses and the classic original, what we think of as the Greek Olympic sports. So I wasn't quite sure if maybe they were trying to suggest that this was the first Olympics or something. I don't know. I don't know anything about the history of the Olympics really, other than it started in Greece. So if anybody knows anything and you guys want to fill me in, that would be really great.
Yeah, I never got the idea it was supposed to be the first Olympics ever, but that was his way of deciding on how he would find the best men to do so. And, you know, but basically only ones who really get a real focus are Hercules himself, who he basically skips giving any challenge to because he realized anyone who gets into the ring with him is going to be a bloody mess. Acastus, who Jason doesn't realize is the son of Peleus, who's basically acting as a mole to make sure that the voyage fails. Hylas, who beats Hercules at a game of discus. And Argus, who basically is the craftsman of the ship, the Argo. Hence the name, the Argonauts are dubs.
Argo, fuck yourself. I'm sorry. That was wrong movie.
When I was rewatching this yesterday, I did think that was a bit odd, where he tells Zeus and Hera. Hera is being played by Honor Blackman from the original of the Avengers TV show. He tells the two of them that he's going to get the best people through Greece and whatnot. And I was curious how he had the power to do that. Did anybody figure that out? Because I mean, if I did that, if I went out and said, "Yeah, I'm going to hire all," you know, people would just laugh at me. So what made?
Well, basically, he probably announced that he was the heir to the throne, that he was the son.
That's what I figured, and then he could send out a decree or something.
Yeah, plus, right.
And he has 18 charisma, Phil.
That's true. He does. Well, he's a hero, so he would have probably 19 or 20, right?
Not to mention, he would probably say, like, hey, I'm going to go for the Golden Fleece, which is probably going to give us guys rich as fuck. Join me.
Yeah, that's a good point. Let's talk about Hera and how she chooses Jason. It's almost like the gods are playing with the humanity, right? They're like toying.
Well, they are. They're not as if they are.
They literally are. They have a chessboard of pieces of people, creatures, and all kinds of stuff. They move each time they decide. And Zeus, and mostly most focused on Zeus and Hera playing against each other and just kind of seeing the results of whatever they put in front of them.
Well, and they sort of did something like that in Clash of the Titans.
Well, yeah.
Where they had the little models and they were moving people around.
I have a question here because my actual knowledge of actual Greek mythology is hazy at best. But I was led to believe by the Hercules television series that Hera had a big fucking problem with Hercules.
Oh, yeah.
Because he was the offspring of Zeus cheating on her. Whereas in this movie, she's trying to help Jason and the crew that he's a part of. Which seemed to be, those two things seem to be at odds with each other. Can anybody clarify that for me?
Well, yes. I don't know that Hercules might go ahead.
Yeah, first of all, understand about half of the Greek island nations were populated by the children of Zeus fucking around on behind Hera's back.
Zeus is like a real gigolo. Yeah. He was a gigolo. Yeah. He fucked everything. Yeah.
But he didn't just fuck them because that would just be too, like, boring. He, like, fucked them as a bull, fucked them as a swan, fucked them as a ray of light. He would fuck them in some weird ass form, you know, fuck them as William Shatner, whatever. He would just take on some.
He would cover the entire nations in Greek dressing.
Yes.
Wow. Wow, Abe went there.
Oh yeah, that's how they explain seafoam. He fucked everything. I mean, that was Greek mythology. It was a lot of drinking, a lot of fucking. That was Greek mythology. And anyway, yeah, so yeah, that's what they had to switch that for the Disney movie of Hercules, because they were like, do we want to have a kid's story about, you know, Hera trying to murder a child because her husband fucked around behind her back? And like, no, just make it the king of the underworld. Nobody likes him anyway.
Now, to get back on track.
Well, I'm sorry, Phil. No, I was going to say, in relation to that, was Hercules one of the Argonauts? Because I didn't think
he was. Yeah, he's listed on there. And actually, it was Heracles, because that was the Greek version. Hercules was the Roman. That's one of those little nitpicks that nerdy little me would have had trouble with.
Right.
Yeah, that's true, because they stuck with the Greek names rather than the Roman names, except for Hercules. So that's true, Mike. But they follow that pretty good, Chrissy, right? Because Hercules, after he screws up, even though it wasn't Talos in the mythos, because Talos was on the way back, he screws up, and so he decides to stay back looking for a person who dies or that's missing, and so Hylas, and he's taken out of the movie fairly early, meaning the demigod or the future demigod in Greek mythology isn't going to be part of the journey when Jason has to fight the Hydra and all that, because this is Jason's story, not really Hercules' story. And so if you had Hercules,
Herod pretty much tells him that Zeus has other plans for him. Once again,
this isn't true. Hera's going to fuck with him.
Probably.
Well, yeah, he does. Hercules is the dumbass that brought Talos to life anyway, so it's all his fault.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I guess when we're talking about Talos, we might as well get into that scene.
Yeah, let's do it. Go ahead, Abe.
All right, so basically, as the voyage goes on, the supplies start running low and people are getting bitchy. They're running out of water and someone want to turn back. So Hera promises she would help Jason, but only do it, I think, five times. So among the assistance that she gives him is to tell him about the Island of Bronze, which is nearby, but warns him that only food and water can be taken and nothing else, because it's being guarded by a giant named Talos, who watches over the area. But now, of course, Jason, not being the best of heroes, says, yes, you guys can take food and water, but nothing else. And yes, Talos will stop you, but doesn't explain what the fuck his Talos is. And, it kind of backfires, because once he gets to the island, Hylas and Hercules see some goats and try to get some meat and milk for the crew. But come upon this field of bronze giants, guarding over like little monuments. Among them sits a statue with the abbreviation Talos there, a giant, monstrous-looking warrior. And they find that this temple he's watching over is open, and go inside, finding, basically belongings of the gods. But for a mortal, they're huge. And among them is a brooch pin that, Hercules thinks, hey, this could make it for a good javelin, and takes it. Which, unfortunately, wakes up Talos, and, it's a bad day for the crew.
He couldn't just put it back, right? That was...
Well, he could have, but unfortunately, by the time they get outside, he sets everything into motion, and Talos starts chasing everyone.
Yeah, and the other thing that was interesting about the Talos scene, too, is that in the original myth, he was a bronze automaton who was made by Hephaestus, but Zeus gave Talos to one of his lovers, whose name was Europa, and Talos guarded her on the island of Crete, because I guess when Zeus was done sleeping with her, he put her on her own island, and then had sent Talos there to protect it from pirates and stuff. And Talos was actually not destroyed by Jason, but he was destroyed by somebody else.
Medea.
But I can't remember.
Medea.
Was it Medea, or was that
Medea?
Yeah. I've got the Wikipedia page open. It was Medea.
Yeah.
Okay.
How do you solve a problem like Medea?
Yeah. So opposed, because in the film, the weakness on Talos is the ankle, but in according to here, there was a single vein with a nail that was driven into it, and should the nail be removed, the fluid that keeps Talos alive would drain out and kill him, which what Medea does here.
Well, and also the way that Talos protected the island, and I listened, I did get a chance to listen to some of the commentary on the Blu-ray, which is with Ray Harryhausen and Dalton, the guy who wrote his book. So it's really, really interesting. And he was saying that the manner that the real Talos in the real myths kills people would have been too graphic for the 60s, because it would have looked like he was peeing on them or something. We're doing something else.
Oh, jeez.
There was a very subtle reference there to, like, jacking off or something like that. I need to go listen to it again.
Well, apparently,
I have to admit, I was a little confused during the Talos scene, because I did not, did everybody know that magic liquid is the way that moving statues work? That was a new one on me.
That's how it was in the original mytho, so.
Oh, was it really? Okay.
Yeah. It's called Ichor, and according to here, it's the ethereal fluid that is the blood of the gods or mortals.
Yeah, and it's supposed to be like basically lava, almost.
Yeah, it's burning fluid.
Magma?
Now, yeah, magma. That's the word I'm looking for. Yeah.
Liquid hot magma, yes.
Now, I read somewhere that, and according to the legend, Talos would actually, in fact, heat himself over a fire, and he would instead embrace his victims.
Okay, maybe that's what Harryhausen was talking about.
And that's what
whatever he said it was hilarious, because it implied that we couldn't have done. He literally said we couldn't have gotten away with that in the 60s. It would have been very inappropriate or something like that. Yeah, and I was like,
he did mention it in the interview, and basically, he would get himself in a fire, heat himself up until he was red hot, and then basically hug a man until he melted, which was way too graphic for what they were going for.
So basically being hugged by a giant waffle maker.
Yeah, basically.
Also the original Talos in the myth, I think, was only 8 feet tall, too, or something.
Yes. Yeah, wrong.
They said that in the commentary, so.
Yeah, but the actual Greeks were only 3 inches tall, so it still worked out.
All right, now, when Talos comes alive in the film, it's arguably one of the greatest scenes in film history as a child, when I was a child. It was just awesome. They're looking around on the beach, and we're looking up from their feet, Hercules's feet, up at the statue in the background, and suddenly the head turns. It was just awesome.
Oh, yeah. It was
pretty cool.
That head turning.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. That head turning moment is awesome. But what's really interesting is I heard on the commentary that Ray Harryhausen said that he got that from. He said that when he was younger, he had seen some kind of Japanese film. Couldn't remember what it was. Just said it was a Japanese film. I saw it when I was young. He said, and there's a scene where the woman was standing with her back to the camera or whatever. And he said, there's a moment where somebody comes in the room and she turned. And he said the creepy way that she turned her head, I never forgot that. And that's where he took that Talos thing from.
Did he mention the name of the film? That.
He did not. He said he couldn't remember it.
Oh, that's too bad.
Well, when he did that commentary, he was God. I mean, up there, so I'm not surprised that he doesn't remember. I know, it's a shame, right? I wish he could remember, because I'd like to see it.
Yeah,
but he said it never left him, and basically the movement that he does with Talos's head is the movement that he saw this woman do in this movie.
Nice. Now, what did you guys think of the Battle of Talos? It goes on for a pretty good long time, which is actually good.
Out of all the creatures in the film, he has the biggest screen time, in fact. I think it's around like 10 minutes Talos was on film. And it's amazing because it's almost like watching a giant bronze slasher villain chase people around. They can't fight him. They can't hold him back because none of the weapons do shit. So they try to make for the shore, the water entrance through the away from the islands, and Talos straddles both islands like the Colossus of Rhodes or something, which is actually basically what they based on the giant size of, and reaches down in this awesome scene and picks up the ship and starts rocking it back and forth, sending all the sailors into the water. I thought that was an incredible scene because it's just amazing how that sense of helplessness you can kind of get there. Because I don't know, I thought it was great. I thought the entire thing scene was great. I thought the screeching sounds and the slow movements that Harryhausen was able to accomplish with this character was really amazing because it just made it all the more creepy.
It was fine. It was a little. I mean, I understand he did the jerkiness on purpose, but because it was there, it made it look a little cheesy to me. I prefer the Hydra and the skeleton scene much more over the Talos scene personally. But I can see how people will get into it.
When I was a kid, it scared me. So it's one of those moments that, like, will haunt me forever. So that's probably my attachment to it. So I can't really see it objectively. But then again, it was straightforward stop motion, or so that was kind of like I could say. I didn't really feel like one of the things I did feel like, how did they do that, was when he actually picked up the boat. I guess that would have been stop motion too, though, huh? They would have just done a model boat.
Right, exactly.
I would have liked a little bit of a higher body count. I don't know, but that also would necessitate more interaction between the, between Talos and the people, and that's more technical problems. It does kind of go on, and mostly a lot of run away. You know, that's mostly the battle,
which makes sense because I mean, when you have a monster the size of an Empire State.
Oh yeah, obviously. Yeah. So maybe I might have abbreviated it a little bit more, but I think it was really good, and it's just for especially for the time. I think it's one of his better sequences.
Yep. If this was if I was a kid and we had, you know, Blu-rays or DVDs back in those days, back in the 70s when I first saw this, I would have been rewatching this film or at least that scene over and over, because it was just such a effective scene, at least personally to me as an individual. This would be one of those scenes that I would have all my friends watch, like, oh my god, you got to see this awesome monster scene. And It's pretty effective. It's as Eric and Mike specifically said, this film really shines with the monsters. Now the next scene I think comes up was the Harpy scene, right? Hey, why don't you explain this scene?
So they ask after taking down Talos and losing Hylas and Hercules, the crew's kind of demoralized, but Hera helps again and tells them to seek out Phineas, a man who's blind but is very knowledgeable and has the sight of the power of prophecy. Unfortunately, he had at some point pissed off the gods and now is being tormented by horrible demons called Harpies that keep him from eating food that's being put by him, before him. So eventually, Jason and his crew arrive after his attack, and Finney says he will help him if they get rid of the Harpies in any way they can.
I'd like to know how long it took them to make that giant net. I mean, because, you know, they do this thing where they throw the net to kind of trap the harpies. And they have the net going around all the ruins. And by the way, my husband made a good point, too. He said, why is everything in ruins when it was supposed to be new?
Yeah, that's...
Like, I mean, that's supposed to be the way they live now. They don't live in ruins back then. They weren't
right, but that was
then.
But that was, but that was kind of how back then it was a big deal to film on location. You know, which meant you're filming in buildings that are 3,000 years old or that are only meant to be 30 years old. You know, but it's so, you know, all those, you know, films set in that time period in the 50s and 60s. Would film. We filmed at the actual Parthenon, which doesn't look anything like the Parthenon would have when it was actually being in use. You know, it's
well. And here's the other thing too. They did say that some of the stuff was shot in Italy, and that scene where in the beginning where there was like a storm and it was getting very dark, where the old soothsayer reveals himself to be Hermes, the messenger.
Yep.
And you look, and behind them, there's the gray clouds and the storm. That was a real storm coming in. And I think that makes that seem very atmospheric. But the fact that they just decided, oh, well, we're just going to use the footage. Anyway, it was supposed to be sunny that day or something. Yeah. And they just decided to keep it. So, but anyway, getting back to your harpies. Does anybody know what Phineas did?
To become tortured by the harpies and maybe even blinded by the guards, too. Because he's supposed to be a king originally.
Well, no, he definitely, the gods did make him blind. Definitely. But I can't, well, I couldn't remember why. It was either like.
I got from the dialogue in the movie that he was given the gift of prophecy. I think he was the dude at the beginning of the movie, wasn't he? But he used his prophecy to help men conquer instead of doing the will of the gods or some such. And that's why he was punished.
That's
what I got from it anyway.
I found something here that gives several different ideas of what happened. So it says Phineas's own blinding was variously attributed to the outrage against his son, or his giving a guy named Phirixus directions on his journey, or because he preferred long life to sight, or as reported in the Argonautica. Thus, best known version for revealing the future to mankind. So basically, he abused his powers in various ways, which pissed off Zeus.
Okay. Okay. So he had all these terrible things happen to him because of it.
Yeah. Mainly the harpies, which kept him from, you know, having a nice snack once in a while.
Okay.
So they're really weird punishment.
It sounds like it from it's just that because he revealed the future to humans and Zeus didn't want him to do that, which I don't understand. If you don't want him to do that, don't let him see the future.
God's the one that gave him that power, so whatever. God's
yeah, but that sounds a lot like Prometheus did stupid shit. Narcissus did stupid shit. They all pissed off the gods by usually giving something to humans so that they weren't supposed to. So that kind of follows suit, you know, with most.
Yeah,
of
but
the
he, why would you give somebody the power to see the future and say, but don't tell anybody, you know,
because
that's,
they're the gods, man. And
they,
like,
yeah, they were dicks. They were massive dicks. All the gods were massive dicks.
Keep in mind this. In the original story of Medusa, she was raped by Poseidon at Athena's temple. And Medusa pleaded for forgiveness for being raped by Poseidon. And what does Athena do? Turn into a Gorgon. The gods are dicks.
We don't give a shit about your rape charges, bitch. You're a Gorgon.
Well, there's the one with the hunters wandering through the woods. And he stumbles upon, was it Artemis who's bathing? And so she turns him into a deer and has six her hounds on him. It's like,
yep.
He just, you know, it's not his. He didn't hunt you out. You just were there. Don't bathe in public if you don't want to see people looking at your nipples or something. It just, oh, well. Anyway, yeah, Greek gods are dicks. So, yeah, so he's being punished. And on his island, he's getting food. And the harpies come and steal the food every day and torment him. And so it's his version of the Sisyphus myth, or who is the one that had the drink?
Tantalus.
Tantalus.
Yes, Tantalus.
Is that where the word tantalizing comes from?
Yeah, because he was cursed to be forever hungry and thirsty, and he was standing like hip deep in a river with a branch of fruit hanging over his head, and whenever he'd reach for the fruit, the branch would pull away. Whenever he'd bend down to drink, the river waters would lower.
The gods are dicks.
Get us wrong.
Massive dicks. Well, sort of like Sisyphus, get the boulder to the top of the hill and you're all good. And of course, every time he gets the boulder to the top, it rolls down.
Right, right. Yeah, and Prometheus with the liver and the eagle and all that other stuff. Yeah. And Pandora. Oh, good Lord. Yeah.
The gods are dicks.
So they.
Abe, you better watch out. They might be gunning for you tonight.
They trap the hoppies, and so he gives them the information to find what's the name of that
Colchis,
which is where the fleece is supposed to be, and another king. But on the way,
because this is way before Google Maps,
that's right. And on the way, we have the big boat scene that you liked, Abe, with Triton, and where Medea is rescued. So let's talk about that for a bit.
All right. So after getting directions, they have to pass through the Clashing Rocks, which, as Phineas says, they speak for themselves what they are. But what they basically are these two peaks of high, jagged cliffs that would shake and slam together if anyone thing was to try to pass it. And they see a small little boat, which Medea is on, suffer that fate. And they themselves try to pass through there. Unfortunately, it's so much chaos that their ship couldn't possibly make it on its own power, and they even lose a crew member in the process. But in frustration, Jason throws a pendant given to him by Phineas of a merman into the ocean, which in effect summons sea god Triton to assist him and hold the cliffs at bay while they pass through. I thought it was a pretty good sequence. I mean, yeah, it's a bit dated, but I thought it was a pretty cool little trick in trying to mix in the live action Triton actor with the crew. I thought it was a nice little different set of flavor after the two creature encounters we had.
Now, Abe, explain who Triton is exactly, because you know a lot of people think Neptune or I should say in the Greek name Poseidon was the god of the seas, but Triton was pretty important too.
Yeah, this is where it gets confusing for people. So Triton is a mythological Greek god. So according to here, he's actually the son of Poseidon and Amphitrite. I'm butchering the fuck out of his name here.
Aphrodite?
No, not Aphrodite.
No.
Amphitrite. It's spelled similarly, but differently.
Okay. Yeah. But he is an actual Greek entity. He's not just another figure they pulled from some random mythology, but he was existed at point. And it's interesting too, because you wondered if it was the pendant or a Hera who summoned him, because during when the crew is pinned down, we cut to a scene of Zeus and Hera playing the chessboard, and Hera sets down the figurine, the chess piece of Triton right in front of the ship.
Now Triton also is one of the two moons of Neptune.
Yes.
Nereid is the other one. So they get through that disaster, but another ship they watch get destroyed, and that happens to be a ship coming from, what's the name of that country again, Abe? Colchis?
Colchis, yes.
Yeah, and they rescue one passenger, which happens to be Medea, who is also, we discover, the daughter of the king of the land of Colchis. So they're heading back. She's going to, instead of head back with them to her homeland. And this is where we meet the king over there, another king with a name that begins with an A. What's it? Anybody know? Anyone?
Oh, it's the king's name is Aetes.
Right, right.
And I love his really awesome beard and his shiny black helmet hair with squigglies.
Yeah, he's actually it looks actually he's got a really good presentation overall. But before we get to Aetes and Colchis, we have to address another scene that unfortunately causes a little monkey wrench in Jason's plan, which is after talking to Medea, Jason decides to go to Colchis by himself to try to find a different way of trying to get his hands on the fleece without, you know, any real fighting. But most of the Argonauts are against that, thinking like, hey, we got 40 of the strongest fighting men in all of Greece. We can take, these guys, which is pretty fucking retarded, but, I guess they're a little high on adrenaline. But then Acastus says we should do a night attack and go for the fleece then. But at a certain point early in the film, Hera had revealed to Jason that the guy he saved in the river was, Pelias, and I guess he puts two and two together that Acastus was in fact Pelias' son, which then leads them to a duel, which at first seems to result in Acastus' death when he drowns in the sea. And well, this is where we are now. Now we're in Colchis.
Seems like a really weird time for him to decide to mutiny.
Yeah, it was a strange thing. I guess they needed a human sword fight, I guess. It was kind of a strange time because that's what I put together because I wasn't sure if that was the case here because he says, and because Jesse goes, during the attack, a man will die with a dagger in his back. That man will be a Greek javelin. Probably yours. So I guess he figured that Cassius was going to stab him in the back, but it was kind of a weird way the whole thing was handled. But that's how I figured it was going.
Well, and actually, what I also thought was a little strange was Jason when they fight, and then he falls in the water, and then he orders a crew member to go in.
Oh, yeah.
After him, instead of going in himself. I was kind of like, okay. Yeah.
His discount Aquaman, Euphemus, he sends out after him. Which, unfortunately...
Oh, right, because we saw him swimming. That's right. Yeah. Okay, no, and you then, just answered my question.
Yeah, and then Euphemus, of course, dies. I love the little scene afterwards. They're like, oh, Euphemus, he's dead. And he's thinking like, oh, well, I guess Cassius must have drowned. And Jason goes, hey, I won.
Yeah. And he goes, oh, the ocean was his life when he was alive. Let the sea have him or something. It's like so casual. It's just like.
Throw him overboard.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is a good example. This is why this story really needed either an epic length or a miniseries, right? Because you have all these characters, like you. You were supposed to remember who this dude was from either your high school Greek mythology class or from the second of swimming you saw earlier in the film. You know, it's none of the characters really got a great deal of development outside of Jason and Hercules.
Pretty much, yeah.
And so this really would be something that you could turn, and you could probably even turn something like this into a TV series, if not even a miniseries.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I mean, there's 85 people you can go through.
It was just a weird way. I was just like, you dick, Jason. You were holding your arm like a bitch, and you sent the guy in and after him.
What did you think of the king? Medea's father.
It's funny here. I thought this short conversation between him and Jason really kind of shows that Jason's pretty much a dick. Because he pretty much says, like, hey, I know you came for the Golden Fleece. And explains to him, if they take the fleece from the Colchis, It would mean famine, destruction of their country. It means bad shit would happen to them. And it's just like, yeah, that's right. You know, these people are not evil people. These guys, people are, this thing has given them, you know, a healthy nation. And should this thing be taken from them, it's going to ruin them. And it's like, wow, Jason, you are a dick.
Well, that's the thing. It's a bizarre thing because he's supposed to be a hero, and yet he's, in theory, stealing something that belongs to them.
Not really in theory.
Well, I enjoyed how the king referred to Jason and his men as pirates. I was like, oh, he's not wrong.
No, and that's true. I know in the movie, in the original story, the king is somehow forced to agree to let Jason go for the fleece by the guard. The
trials, yeah.
What he does is he sets up trials for Jason to do, and that's where we get the teeth that turn into warriors and all this other stuff. So it's a little different here. So the movie oddly doesn't make him sympathetic. Well, in the, I mean, it makes Jason look like Eric, you said, they're pirates, right?
Yep.
Yeah, Phil. Just so you know, the actor Jack Willem, who played the king,
yes,
you know, he was a character actor, had been around for many, many, many years. He played Poseidon in Clash of the Titans, and he also played Van Helsing in the Monster Squad, and had the, I'm sure, must have been a pivotal role of club secretary in one of your favorite films, Lawrence of Arabia.
Oh, okay. That's interesting. Which is another interesting thing was Beverly, whatever the screenwriter's last name was, I forget his name. He actually was uncredited as one of the screenwriters for Lawrence of Arabia as well. So there's two connections to Lawrence of Arabia, the best film in the history of the world. From that are in this movie, which by the way only came out a couple of years earlier than this movie. So that guy actually had a pretty good career then, Mike.
The last thing he did was in 2001, so he was around for a while,
right? And I assume he probably just passed away or at that point.
Let me take a look. I didn't see when he died. Yeah, that's when he died. It was 2001. So he was working. He was born in 1909. So he had a nice long life, almost head into his 90s. So 92, yeah. I guess.
Wow, yeah, he was working all the way into his 90s.
Yep,
unbelievable. So Jason, but you know what? It's weird though. Is that even though Jason is a thief, the gods are telling him to do it too, right? So it's like, wait, what did you say no to the gods? So I mean, it was a no-win situation. The guy got screwed.
Pretty much.
Well, he had to get. It was the only way he thought he could get his nation back to its rightful strength. But the way it's handled, kind of makes Jason come off as villainous, or at least apathetic to the this country's, you know, reasons for needing the fleece. You know, the character is not one of the strong points of this film.
Right, right. Let's talk about the Hydra. And then we'll talk about the skeletons. The Hydra is interesting. Is that the usurper king that Jason wants to overthrow? His son actually is the one that, like, you know, turns him in as the quote unquote pirate. And then he himself goes off to fight the Hydra to steal the Golden Fleece as well.
Well, he has no idea what's waiting for him where the fleece is. All he thinks is, hey, it's on a tree. I can go grab it and bugger off back home. He doesn't realize he's getting for a multi-headed surprise.
Abe, excellent English term there, bugger off. I like it. Good job.
Yeah. But
the Hydra, too, every time you cut off one head, two grow in its place.
Yeah. And
but the original Golden Fleece was actually guarded by a fire-breathing dragon, right?
Yeah.
But
Hydra was actually killed by Hercules in another battle. Yep.
Yeah. But, Harry Houser didn't want to do another dragon because he already did one for the Seventh Voyage and wanted to do something different. What's ironic is that the Hydra is really cool, but Harry Houser said that it was a lot of complications with animating this creature because he had 7 heads, 14 eyes, 2 whipping tails, and of course a southern body chasing Todd Armstrong, who plays Jason, around the place. And it's like a 3-minute, 4-minute scene. So he'd be working on trying to remember where the heads moved, whether back and forth or closed their mouths or tongues slithering out. And sometimes forget where he was at, and it would be a pain. It was a pain in the ass, he pretty much said. Not literally, but it was a frustrating animation. But interestingly enough, though, it pays off because the creature is fantastic. It's got a really cool design with these dinosaurian-like heads with these black beaks and his curved, like, ram-like horns. And it's got these awesome... The sound that his thing can make is really badass. I mean, it's a really cool, gorgeous-looking creature. And the way it moves and glides around, the fight takes place as well. I just loved it. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, the Hydra really was pretty impressive. There was... Mike was talking a little bit about how a lot of stop motion is look at the creature, then cut to the actor and see them go, ah, and then cut back to the creature. And there's a little bit of that going on in this scene. But I really think it's second to the skeletons as far as my enjoyment of the monsters in the movie. I was on board for Talos, and then I really wasn't too thrilled about the harpies and the Triton scene. But then once we got to the Hydra, I was back on board.
Yeah, and as I said, I also love how the design, this kind of blue and black kind of coloring, works so well as a contrast to the layer and the golden fleece. It was just really, very beautiful presentation, and I love the music that we use. It's kind of like almost like a Snake Charmer song going on in the background. I thought it was just a really awesome scene, and I despite the troubles that Harryhausen probably faced while animating it, I thought he pulled it off amazingly.
Yeah, the Hydra was most certainly one of the high points of the film. As you said, Eric, this was in the skeletons. Were your two favorite scenes? I think that's what you said, right?
Yes, that is what I said.
Yeah. So even though I loved the Talos scene, the film. Even though the ending wraps up where it's left off as a sequel coming, it does go out in a bang with the Hydra battle and then the skeleton battle, which we'll talk about in a second. Now, do you think that based off of what the fleece does, it was worth it, right? Because who dies or gets hurt where they put the fleece
Medea.
On them?
Oh, yeah, Medea gets shot in the back. While
yeah, because they're fleeing. Yeah, exactly. They're trying to flee from her father's warriors, and she gets shot by an arrow.
Yeah, and before we get to the attempted escape, after Jason shanks the Hydra, Aeetes decides, you know, he's going to bring out the big guns after the Guardian was murdered, and calls on Akati to give him the Hydra's teeth, and has the body burned by magic fire. And the teeth are dug out from the skeleton. The fire was kind of cheesy. I kind of liked how there was this kind of big build up to this, the children of the night, the children of the Hydra's teeth. You know, if you were back in that period of time, it's the first watching this film, and you're wondering what they are, I just thought it was a nice little mystery to what these creatures were going to be.
Now let's talk about this final battle. With the skeletons, Mike, it was you, who, or was it you, Chrissy, or actually probably all of you, watched the documentary. I know you did, Eric, too. Does anybody want to? I saw the documentary, but I watched it like a year or 2 years ago. I didn't get to rewatch it for this episode. Anybody want to explain what Harriet Hawson said about the skeletons?
It was really fucking hard.
Yeah, why was that?
And it took a long time.
Yeah, it was like 3 to 4 months to animate the entire thing. Basically because you had 3 actors and you had 7 skeletons. And basically what happens a lot of times with the combat with humanoid or smaller creatures and the Harryhausen films is a lot of shadow boxing and practicing of line of sight. Basically lining up the actor's gaze with the creature. So what Harryhausen had to do was he had to have seven stuntmen with numbered T-shirts spar with the actors to rehearse the movement for a number of times. Then, after they felt the actors got down, the actors would shadow box with invisible opponents, and then from there, once they got the moves down, Harryhausen would animate skeletons on top of there to make it seem like the three actors were fighting the creatures.
That's right. I do remember that he said that in the documentary. So the actors, after fighting their shadow opponents so many times where they got the specifics down, then they did it without the shadow fighters there. And that's when he would then splice the film of the skeleton on top of the film of the actual people. I actually thought the movements by the folks were pretty damn good. Even if no one's there and they're fake fighting, it was a lot of times when stuff like that happens, you can tell it looks fake. I mean, even fights between two people in movies, especially back in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, look fake. And yet here, they were pretty. It was pretty spot on, pretty good, I thought.
Now this, this scene was not only an achievement in stop motion, but also an achievement in choreography, because the human actors and the skeletons seemed to interact seamlessly. And like I said, I was ultimately impressed with the skeleton scene because of that. Because they like I said, Game of Thrones 2 years ago still can't do it better than Ray Harryhausen did it in the 60s.
Yeah, and I think every now and then film comes up with something that fucks actors up, and like when you went from sound to talkies, screwed people up because it was a different acting style. And recently, green screen acting has been a problem. Not every actor has been able to successfully interact with a green screen. I remember when Star Trek The Next Generation was on the air, all the actors would praise Brent Spiner, who played Data, because they said he could convincingly act to nothing. And a lot of the actors had trouble with that. And so that's something modern actors have trouble with, and modern actors have to learn how to deal with, because there's so much CGI, whether it's for monsters or simply background, they have to learn how to act to nothing in a way that they didn't used to have to do. And this is a good example of it, being able to fight nothing and make it seem as if it's real instead of just playing air guitar.
Right. Yeah, exactly, and that's the key. And Eric, you summed it up with the word, which is exactly what it was: is choreographed, and it's amazing. Because I mentioned, you know, the editor, the cinematographer, and various other folks, but whoever did the choreography for this film, you got to give them credit, and you got to give the actors credit too, because a lot of these actors, I wonder if some of these actors that played these no-name Argonauts that die in this battle were professional, whatever, these type of things.
Dancers
shatter,
or
yeah, whatever.
And, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
I did hear somebody say in the commentary that one of the, I think it was during the, quote, Olympic sequence, I'm just going to call it that for lack of a better term, that a couple of the Argonauts were just stuntmen.
Yeah. Fernando Poggi, who plays Cassie, who fights with Jason, the one who gets cut down when he's trying to climb the pillar, is actually, if I recall, he was actually a stuntman coordinator for some of the swords and stuff. So, you know, because I kind of, you know, I think, and it kind of makes sense because I thought his movements were a little more fluid than some of the other actors in terms of some of the things he tried to pull off. Because if I recall, he kind of helped in coordinating some of the fight scenes, and maybe the skeleton scene was one of them.
Okay, all right. So the more of the skeleton scenes, I mean, oddly, most all the folks that fought the skeletons besides Jason were.
I found it. Fernando Poggi was their sword master.
Oh, okay. There you go. So that answers that. They were all basically red shirts, which was interesting. But what other things about the skeletons that folks wanted to bring up? Anything?
Oh, there's one, it's one little thing. If you look closely when the skeletons are rising up, two of them actually are wearing the creatures from some of Ray Harryhausen's older films. One of them has the Ymir from the 20,000 million miles to Earth on his shield, and another one has the Sixtopus from It Came Beneath the Sea.
Oh, that's interesting. So he put in some Easter eggs.
Yep.
That's cool.
Cool.
I was really impressed by, I knew it was stop motion, but I was very impressed with how they came up out of the ground. I'd forgotten how good that looked. Like,
that was awesome.
Yeah, like really convincing, like they were. And I just sat there going, how did he do? I mean, I know they did it with stop motion, but like just to get the way that they broke through the ground just right. That's right. Incredible.
Every piece of stone and that had to be stop motioned as well as the monster.
Yeah, incredible.
I love the music too, because it had like the sound of bones creaking and cracking as well. There's a lot of use of cool.
A lot of percussion.
Yeah, a lot of percussion. But it's kind of really cool. It's each moment that you break through the ground, you hear like a crack sound, like the bones creaking and like the same thing with the Hydra in terms of, like there's almost a snake charmer music. There's a lot of music that kind of fits well with the creatures. Like they almost have their own theme song.
And now you got to give that credit to Bernard Herrmann.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
I heard he's pretty good.
Yeah, me too. I did too. Someone that worked with people like Orson Welles and Alfred Hitchcock. It's pretty impressive. Yeah. Never mind Ray Harryhausen. Let's talk about the ending, the part where I was like, this sucks.
Yeah, because he never even makes it back to the kingdom, right? It's just...
Right, because I thought this whole...
Basically, he gets away from the skeleton, dives off a cliff into the ocean, the skeletons sink, he doesn't, he makes it back to the ship, kisses Medea, and Hera and Zeus are watching through their magic pool, or whatever the fuck that is, and Hera's like, game over! And Zeus is like, nope, I've got more plans for him. And then the end.
Yeah. There were plans for a sequel of Continuum Adventures, but it never made it I think it was you, Phil, that mentioned that he went back to going to the Sinbad films instead.
Now, the thing that I think that was actually Mike, you may have mentioned that. The thing that's interesting is the story was basically him overthrow the usurper and become the king like he was rightfully was supposed to be, and get vengeance on the usurper. I think if they had just changed, originally the film was supposed to be called Jason and the Golden Fleece, but they changed it to Jason and the Argonauts. And if they didn't change the name, then I guess it wouldn't have ended as weirdly as it did, because then we would have figured the movie was basically the search for the Golden Fleece, not the search to get revenge on.
There was an entire return journey that was left off. There was a point where they had to had a few other encounters with other strange creatures, and then there was also, of course, the overthrow of Pelias and Jason becoming king, and then the tragedy of Jason that would unfold afterwards, in which Medea would kill his children, and then while sitting under the rotting hull of the Argo, a piece would fall and break Jason's neck.
Hey guys.
Yeah.
I just want to cut in here. Unfortunately, Christy does have a time limit tonight, which is coming up quick here, so why don't we get her final thoughts on the movie before she has to go?
Okay.
Okay, yeah. Well, I'll give my final thoughts and then I will sign off, but we pretty much got through the whole film. I think this movie is fun. I think it's like having, like I said, a cup of coffee with an old friend. The creatures just can't be beat. The score is amazing. This is a great film and you owe it to yourself to check it out, and you should get it on Blu-ray. And also, if you do get the newest Blu-ray that's out there, it's got two different commentaries. It's got, you know, that special that they had referred to, the feature-length special narrated by Leonard Nimoy. And it's got some other stuff on there that's really worth owning. So definitely check it out. High recommend. Lots of fun. And it's kind of nice to just turn your brain off and just be entertained.
All right, very good. So, Chrissy, we'll be back next week. We'll be wrapping up probably within the next 5 minutes too. But next week we'll get to that Get Out episode that was supposed to be this week. So, all right. So, Chrissy, we'll talk to you later and say hi to Nate. And hopefully his interview will be pretty damn good. With
I hope so.
Let us all know who it is next week. What's that?
I will. I'll tell you when I know. Yep. He's actually warming up now, so I have to go, but I'll talk to you guys later.
Okay.
All right. Take care.
All right. Bye.
Have a good one. Bye.
Okay. She gone? We could talk about her?
Now, Abe, in the mythology, wasn't it Medea marries Jason and they have 5 kids, right?
Yes, they do. But eventually, Jason betrays her for another woman, and out of rage, Medea kills the children and leaves.
What?
And yep, and
that makes no sense.
Yeah, character development was
Greeks
their strong
are stupid
point.
And can't keep it in their pants.
And then Jason dies after getting crushed under the rotten hull of the Argo.
Jesus, it's a terrible story.
Well, a lot of these Greek stories end pretty shitty.
Well, to be fair, I don't think that whoever the genius was who came, no one had written the line, and they all lived happily ever after. They hadn't written that line yet, and so the Greeks were all struggling for the ending.
I always thought Jason was a stupid name for a hero, too. I mean, that's a normal name. I want to hear Achilles and Ajax and all those guys.
Right, well. Well, yeah, you look and look at all the names and Hercules, Ajax, Achilles, Asclepius, the Topius, and Polybius, and Jimmy the Argonaut. No, just and Jason,
Louis.
I know. I always thought it was stupid.
Tim. But,
yeah, Tim. That's great. Geez. Anyway. All right. So, any further thoughts that people wanted to bring up about the film before we get into our final thoughts? Anything that we missed or related to Ray Harryhausen that anybody wanted to bring up?
I think we've been pretty extensive. I think we can wrap this up.
Yep.
All right. Sounds good. So, let's go with Mike. Mike, why don't you start? Give her your final thoughts of the film and all that good stuff.
Well, you know, kind of what we talked about with A Cure for Wellness. This is a sort of film that. If it's you know anything about the film, you should know if this is the sort of film you'd be interested in. I would say especially if you have any interest in film effects and the history of film effects, for that reason alone you should watch it, and probably just as, if not more importantly, seek out all the extra materials and interviews and making of stuff, because really the effects are what this film is about. And you know, it's not about, even though there are some fine actors in this, it's not about the acting. It sure as hell is not about the writing and the storytelling, or the cinematography. It's all about the effects, and that's what you want to see. And, it is some of Harryhausen's best work, I think. And pretty much everyone thinks, and certainly Ray thinks it, so, or thought it.
Yeah, that's true. He did. And it is, a really good movie, too, especially if you like fantasy films or, genre films that aren't necessarily offensive, similar to Star Wars, and films like that where anybody could watch it and enjoy it as long as you like science fiction or fantasy. Like someone like my wife would say, okay, 5 minutes, we're done. I don't like this stuff. It's fake. But, you know, for us with that are big fans of fantasy, this is a great film. I don't know if I would point people to it first, just for the fact that I love the Sinbad films. But some of his sci-fi films from the '50s are great too. But, this one easily, fits right in with the Sinbad films and The Crash of the Titans, and many people like it the best of the bunch. So it's really just a preference of which of his fantasy films you like more or less. Either way, high recommend. A lot of great set pieces and a good time. Abe.
I thought, okay. So, I might end up echoing what much has been said, but I'll still say it. If you love film in terms of like its history, and especially in terms of animation, this is something you can definitely check out to see what stop motion and some of the older effects had achieved. It's got a great – the real stars of this film are the creatures that Harryhausen brings to life. Talos, the Harpies, the Hydra, the Golden Fleece, the Skeletons, they are the real stars, and they are fantastic results of one man's hard work and craftsmanship. There's a great score by Bernard Herrmann. There's some great cinematography, and it's a lot of fun. And if you like older fantasy films, this is right up your alley. It won't be a film for everybody, but it's definitely something to check out. I recommend it. And even if it's on my all-time favorite Harry Hudson film, it's definitely up there. And so I think this film is awesome overall.
And Eric?
Yeah. Like Mike referred to earlier, this isn't really my flavor. It's generally not the type of movie that gets me really excited. However, just because of the superior quality of the stop motion effects, I would recommend this to people to go check out just for that. So yeah, it's a recommend, even though the movie generally isn't my style.
Yeah, very good. All right, so that's our first Ray Harryhausen film that we haven't done on the podcast. Oddly, as I stated earlier, twice it almost became an episode. Me and Mike originally back in like the first 30 episodes were thinking of doing a retrospective, and then the four of us before Chrissy joined, we were going to do four episodes of four Ray Harryhausen, similar to like we did the Killer Fish Fest. We were going to do a Harryhausen Fest, and it just never occurred because of like I know
we had a lot of shit on our plate.
Indeed, we
did. It took us a year to get to this.
That's true. Yeah, this was part of a poll from a year ago. Yeah, we finally got to a Ray Harryhausen film, which is good. Highly recommend many of his films, probably almost all his films, to be honest. I don't know. I'll see if any of you guys want to say any last things before, because who knows when we're going to do the next Ray Harryhausen film.
You know, I'd say this, we loved hearing feedback from the listeners, and I know if you are an older genre fan or a fan of older genre films, there are going to be people out there having a strong emotional connection to Harryhausen and Harryhausen films, like I do, like Abe does, like Christy does, like you do, Phil. Not like Eric, but that's okay. He's allowed. So if there's like a favorite Harryhausen film or monster or sequence, you know, why not drop us a note either on Facebook or through darkdiscussions@AOL.com, and maybe we can read some of your stuff on the air or the internet or whatever this is called. Because this is all a communal thing, so.
That's excellent.
I'd be curious to hear it.
Yeah. Anybody who wants to give their thoughts of their favorite Ray Harryhausen film and their experiences and what he means to you, because a lot of these films were discovered as when we were children. If anybody wants to email darkdiscussions@AOL.com, please do. And we will most certainly read your opinions of Ray Harryhausen. And it doesn't have to be Chasing the Argonauts. It could be anything to do with any of his films, whether it's his sci-fi films or his fantasy films and so forth. So, yeah, excellent idea, Mike. So hopefully we'll hear from some of our listeners. So with all that stated – actually, one question for you, Abe. So you're happy, Abe? We finally did a Ray Harryhausen film?
Oh, yeah, I'm so glad because, you know, as you said, we were planning on doing a big tribute to him, and so much had happened that it seemed like we never get a chance to do so. So I'm really happy that we finally gave him the recognition that, you know, this important figure in our film history had deserves. And because of how much he's brought to film and the genre in general. So this is awesome. This was a great episode.
Yeah, it was. And folks who are younger than even Abe that may want to check these films out, just search for Ray Harryhausen, H-A-R-R-Y-H-A-U-S-E-N, German-American. And get your parents to buy or rent some of his films for you, because you'll enjoy them a lot. So with all that stated, I guess we can wrap it up. So, Eric, why don't you lead us out?
All right. Thanks for tuning in to listen to us talk about Jason and the Argonauts tonight. Come back next week. We'll be talking about
Get Out.